Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Fringe Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you, man?
Hi, Nick and Terrence. Doing well, thanks. Looking forward to our wide-ranging conversation this afternoon.
Indeed, indeed. And, of course, we also have Mr. Terrence Corrigan. Terrence, how are you doing, sir?
I'm good. I'm good. And yourself?
I'm pretty good, pretty good. Without electricity, but, you know, that's pretty normal these days. Just before I start off, I want to say to everyone, please go to the rr.org.za and the campaigns page, of course, expropriation without compensation via the expropriation bill is being fought by us. Yesterday, myself and Gabriel Krauser did a little video on this outside of the Constitutional Court. And I believe today the committee has its last opportunity to delete the very bad parts of the bill from the bill. I think section 12 is the worst of all the passages. So please join our campaign to oppose EWC, because I'm sure, as you've heard many times on the show, the economic consequences for not just white South Africans, not just rich South Africans, not just pick your favorite group South Africans, but everyone will be catastrophic. Okay. So let's get into the news. And I think we're going to start off with a bit of a long analysis piece here written by our former colleague, Gareth van Onselen, who is the head of a foundation called, I think, Victory Polling, which polls a number of things. But one of the things it polls is election support for various parties. Now, in cooperation with I think it's called the South African Social Research Foundation, Victory Polling released a series of polls recently about where the electorate currently is with regards to which political party they support and who supports each party and what the state in all the provinces is of party political support. This poll was a little bit different from some of the ones which were leaked to, I think, a report, which say things like that. This poll said that the ANC was a little bit above 50%, and I think we've actually talked about it in an episode about 2 weeks ago. However, today, Gareth has written a piece examining the Democratic Alliance and where it stands. And I think it's worth dissecting for a little bit, because, of course, the DA is the second largest party in the country. I think, to the surprise of many analysts, this polling, a lot of the polling that's come out recently has shown that the DA seems to be at least stabilizing and recovering after its difficult previous two elections. In 2019, when it went backwards, dropped from up around 22% support to around 20% support. And the last local government election, where although its overall support levels were fairly stable, it lost a bunch of wards all over the country, which were not great for it. But these polls suggest that that trend may be reversing, and it's worth, I think, discussing maybe why this has happened, or if we think this is indeed the case. So firstly, these polls show that I am going to be simplifying here, because if you model for turnout, you can get very different results here, but that the DA is sitting on around 25% support from the electorate. That it seems to be on about 38% in a place like Gauteng, 23% in KZN, and 61% in the Western Cape. In terms of the racial breakdown of their support, about 10% of Black South Africans are currently expressing support for the DA, 73% of Coloureds, 58% of Indians, and 59% of Whites. Now, what's interesting about, I mean, I think it's a little bit crass if we look at this stuff from such a racial point of view. But what's interesting about this is actually this is quite a big drop in the percentage of whites who say they will support the DA. In the last election, it was 73%, and quite a big jump in the black support, which was around 4% at the last election. And part of that is because parties like the Freedom Front Plus and Action SA have managed to scoop off some of the white vote. But the DA seems to be doing all right at these polls because of its growth amongst black voters. which I think runs very contrary to the sort of mainstream narrative, which is that the DA is becoming this kind of reactionary right-wing white party. Some other interesting things. John Steenhuisen doesn't have a great favorability rating amongst voters, but the overwhelming largest block of voters in the country are just unfavorable. Unfamiliar with John Steenhuisen. They don't even know who he is, which is, I think, a serious problem for him that he needs to overcome. 37% of voters say they don't know who John Steenhuisen is enough to have an opinion of him. In contrast, that number is 0 for Cyril Ramaphosa and 2% for Julius Malema. Your thoughts in general. Terence, let me start with you. What do you make of this? Do you think that this 25% number is reasonable for what the DA might expect in 18 months' time when the election is held? What do you make of the reasons why the racial demographics are evolving in the way they are?
Look, 18 months is a hell of a long time to go. You know, you can snatch a victory from the jaws of defeat in a couple of hours if you like particularly conscientious about doing so.
And we're not in an election season now, so things could change an awful lot going ahead.
But I don't know. This seems plausible to me. I think that. In as much as there's a certain unfamiliarity with John Steenhuisen, I think that's matched by much of the commentariat. Now, I hold no great brief for Steenhuisen myself, but I think that he's often been kind of reduced to a bit of a sort of straw man figure that you can project your sort of views or pathologies about society onto. I haven't seen many examples where people have actually tried to sit down with him to probe his thoughts, maybe good thoughts or bad thoughts. But I think he's been reduced to this caricature of the white man in charge of the white party. I think that it's important to bear in mind why people might be sympathetic or choose to vote for a party, which is not necessarily favorability towards that party, but could be, protest votes, could be particular irritation with the incumbent. About 10 years ago, I remember, I think it was the 2009 election. I remember thinking to myself this, and there were a number of other people who made the same point. Max Dupree, for instance, someone who's not particularly fond of the DA. Made the point that this seems to be the election where it became acceptable to support the DA. You had letter writers to publications like Sowetan and City Press in their own names, saying they're gonna give it a chance. Often less because of any great affection for the DA than. Disillusionment with the ANC in a sense of, well, the DA might run the show better. So, we'll have to wait and see. But I think if there's maybe one takeaway that I don't think has been properly explored, a lot's been said about the environment becoming more competitive, given the problems in the ANC and the dimming of its luster. I think the opposition space has seen the same. The DA has, in a sense, also, to defend what has traditionally been its turf. The Freedom Front Plus and Action SA, as this poll suggests. They have a comparable issue, perhaps on different scales, but don't take things for granted.
Chris, what do you make of these poll results? Do you agree with what Terence is saying?
No, I think terribly interesting, especially given some overriding narratives which have taken hold in the last while around reducing. Maybe a certain population group's reasons or not for voting against or for the DA, so maybe countering or undermining some of those those narratives. I mean, a lot obviously hinges on turnout. So can any of these particular parties animate voters enough to turn out on voting day and make their mark, as it were? The
right,
DA
and,
will
and in
take...
If I could just interrupt you briefly, the analysis here that Gareth Arnoldson writes, he says that a lot does depend on turnout and that some aspects of turnout are very difficult to model properly. So firstly, we don't know what the turnout is going to be for the national election, full stop. But we also don't know, for example, to what degree opposition voters in general may turn out more than ANC voters or vice versa, right? And that means that the end results of these polls, or even if the election were held right today, these polls would probably be still off by a bit because they don't capture those specific dynamics perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if ANC voters turn out to a sufficient extent, should the assumption be that they will necessarily vote for the ANC, or will they try and vote to indicate some sort of dissatisfaction? Will they not decide to pitch up? I think it's all terribly interesting. I do think just with the DA specifically, they will take their wins, as it were, from this, because the focus, I think, has been for the party leadership about stabilizing the ship and fixing some of the leaks and trying to make sure that you keep your support as relatively strong in terms of what it should have been in the past, but where you lost it in terms of your messaging, your ideological stances, maybe some mixing of issues and compromising on ideological points. So the leadership will take wins from this polling, but the danger, of course, is that you then rest on that progress and you don't continue moving forward to a sufficient extent to grow your support. And then again, there's the question around, should the DA still aim to be the main opposition? Should there be a case for it being the strongest leader in a wild dog coalition, maybe? Those sorts of questions on strategy and tactics, I think, are also still quite interesting. But yeah, useful, I think, going towards 2024 to see where some things potentially lie. This is all quite, I think, interesting in a good way going forward.
Yeah, Terence, you mentioned sort of growing competitiveness. And I think in general, there's going to be a lot of growing competitiveness as we go forward to 2024, because I suspect there are going to be several new political groups trying to join in the fray, some which maybe have some quite significant backing behind them, at least in terms of finance or maybe name or brand or something like that. Because, you know, the moment that anyone thinks that they might be part of a governing coalition, even with relatively few seats, the incentives for getting into the political arena are much higher. Do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's something that we can look forward to, or look out for, perhaps would be a better expression, in the coming election, is that there's likely to be, I think, a wider choice on that opposition side. People like Sengeza Zibi and Magashule Ghana, you know, will they, you know, where will they draw their support from? Ghana, of course, has quite a strong and long-standing background in the DA. I think what you're likely to see is a series of Venn diagrams where people are sort of pulling from different pools. But I don't know. If I'd say, you know, what's the big takeaway of all of this? Politics certainly seems to be developing into a much more competitive and unpredictable game. For the DA as much as for the for the ANC. Look, I mean, and my comment earlier about not knowing what you know, not knowing or taking much of an interest in what John's DNA is and is. I think that it's a failure of much public comment that I don't think we have the intellectual curiosity always in our public discourse, and I think we could do with a great deal more. And before anyone tries to flame me in the comments, I'm sure that I could do better there as well.
No, I think that's exactly right, that we are heading for turbulent times when there will be a lot of opportunities to both succeed and to fail. So You know, everyone in politics is going to have to sharpen their wits and their metaphorical swords, or else they shall be left behind. Okay, so yeah, obviously we're going to keep watching that, but very interesting and food for thought. Let's move on to our next topic. The president, as part of his efforts to attract foreign investment to the country, to tout South Africa as a good investment destination, was visiting major hubs for exports, and he was visiting a facility south of Durban yesterday, where he expressed some displeasure with the state of our ports and rail infrastructure. Ramaphosa said, "We have made progress in our rail and port operations, but more needs to be done for SAPI to export its products. I was not pleased when I heard the 75,000 tons of products stay in the warehouses because of the lack of capability of our ports to export. It comes down to efficiency. That is what we want to focus our attention on, where we can and must improve the operation of our ports and rails. This will be able to allow SAPI to grow more." There was also nearby a damaged bridge, which is scheduled to be repaired by April 2023. And Ramaphosa said he was not pleased to hear that it will only be fixed by next April, and he thought that we could do better. So, Chris, this is a passion for you. You're interested in infrastructure stuff, trade. Firstly, what do you make of the president's comments? And secondly, what is the solution here to improving our export capacity?
I think President Ramaphosa's comments would have been more impressive if he'd made them standing at a podium backlit with red lighting and some ominous music playing in the background. Maybe then I would have taken him more seriously about voicing his displeasure. I think it's indicative of the NEC, let's say, of the ANC and the cabinet's attitude towards solving serious problems in the country, where when they get on the ground, those problems hit them. But when they then go back again to Pretoria and Cape Town, they can be protected from the destructive consequences of their policies. So, for example, maintaining Transnet's monopoly, maintaining Eskom's monopoly in electricity, so meaning that you can't have reliability in terms of moving your goods, you can't have reliability in terms of predicting when perhaps you'll have power, when you won't, all these sorts of things point to that. So the president can throw his hands and wag his finger and be indignant, but his words don't change the inhibiting consequences of his own chosen policies. And I don't see something like Transnet, for example, being privatized or competition being allowed for that anytime soon. There is talk of bringing in private investors on a few rail corridors, but Transnet remains the custodian of those infrastructure investments and those developments for 2 years. So you can do this for the two-year pilot study. You can throw your capital at this, but at the end of the day, Transnet can still take away the infrastructure and your investments at any point. So will that really get the necessary upgrades going? I don't think so, neither in terms of rail or in ports. In terms of improving what we need to do to improve, I mean, it's looking at places that have done the basics right. So I'm not asking for a revolution overnight, but things like digitization, being able to track your container when it comes in, how long it takes to move through, having the necessary amount of brackets on trucks that containers don't sit there in the port forever before they get moved out, having the necessary personnel in terms of checking meat products and fruit and that sort of thing, so it doesn't only hinge on one person, for example, working at Cape Town Harbour, checking lamb coming in or that sort of thing. Yeah, those basics, and electricity, having competition so we can up our own manufacturing game. At the moment, we're relying a lot more on imports. That's going to weaken the rand, and it's going to mean South Africans have less money to spend on consumable goods than they did before. So all in all, don't expect any change anytime soon. Maybe even harsher words from the president when he goes to visit again in a year's time. Maybe that will really move people to act, but I don't think so.
Like, at least he didn't say he was shocked, because I think that line is
getting old. Yeah, he can't be, because there's no electricity for him to be shocked. But,
Yeah, so, you know, our export infrastructure, I think, is very important because, you know, we do have a lot of commodities in this country, and they are probably one of the things that we can get fired up and working quite quickly, I think, if we fixed, or at least started fixing some of our major economic problems, you know, like business regulation and the electricity supply, stuff like that. But, you know, there's no good opening a massive new coal mine or whatever if you can't send the goods out. Terence, what are your thoughts on this topic?
Well, I was going to say, I wonder if you were shocked. You know, you beat me to the punch there. President Ramaphosa, I think, like the ANC as a whole, is just too enthralled to particular modes of thinking. It can't break out of that, and this is why I think the idea of Ramaphosa as a reformer was always optimistic. Mm-hmm. You know, on any kind of major issue, the solution is not to do things differently; it's to do them better. So, and this, you know, this goes from the from what I call the banal, you know, we got to like run local government, municipal governments better. Yes, of course we do. To the more significant, you know, we shouldn't privatize Eskom. We need a second Eskom. Okay, that was a good one. You know, all the way through to cadre deployment. You know, the illegal and unconstitutional thing that has wrecked the civil service. That, you know, we spent R1 billion for the Zondo Commission to lay bare in its guts and glory. No. Cadre deployment's good. You know, we just have to do it better. And you know, don't blame cadre deployment for all the stuff that happened under Zuma, because we lost those minutes and you can't prove that we actually deployed these people. There's something that's quite surreal about all of this. I think sadly, and you know, I say this with all sincerity. President Ramaphosa, you know, he had an opportunity. He could have acted on it, but I just don't think it was within his political repertoire. It was a bit, you know, I remember a political science professor of mine talking about P.W. Bircher in the 1980s, that there was a certain reformist impulse, but the repertoire was limited. You know, the tricameral parliament was one thing. Full, you know, non-racial franchise was just never within his mental framework. I think for Ramaphosa, it's much the same thing.
Any final thoughts, Chris, before we move on?
Only that for South African businesses and exporters at this point, if they haven't already, I hope that they're looking at getting stuff out through Namibia and Maputo and places like that, because I don't foresee that they'll get necessary growth trying to rely on Cape Town and Durban specifically, especially with the damage unfortunately caused in Durban. And if they haven't repaired one bridge by now, then don't hold your breath.
Definitely. Okay, we're not going to talk for long about this one. Just going to briefly mention it. The ongoing impeachment hearing of the public protector, Busisiwe Mkhwebane, is going ahead in Parliament still. And she is being represented by her advocate, Dalia Mpofu, the most famous of EFF advocates. And there was recently a bit of a kerfuffle yesterday because Dalia Mpofu threatened the chairperson of the inquiry, who's an ANC MP. And now several MPs have asked that Mpofu be investigated for it. It is illegal to threaten an MP when they're performing their duties and can carry a prison sentence of up to 3 years. In one of the exchanges, which was, of course, filmed, as most things in Parliament are, Mpofu was complaining to the ANC chairperson of the inquest committee as to how he was being treated. He didn't feel like he was being respected properly, and he said, quote, "You are not entitled to abuse me like you are abusing me. I am senior to you in many ways, not just in age, but in many ways. You know it, so you have no right to abuse me. But fine, you have your power now. You can exercise it. But you'll pay one day, yeah." And the chairperson replied, "Are you threatening me now?" And Mpofu responded, "Yeah." So the chairperson asked him to conclude his remarks, and Mpofu said, "Actually, it's not a threat. It's a promise." Terence, what do you make of this? I mean, Mpofu has been, shall we say, this is not the first time that he's been accused of saying something insulting in one of these important forums. I think the Judicial Service Commission was the other relatively recent incident when he assaulted someone and then was found to, because he had said it in Xhosa, I think, that he wasn't in fact insulting someone. And I don't know. This is just all leaves a bit of a bad taste in my mouth. What are you making of this, Terence?
I think that this is the kind of politics that a party like the EFF indulges in. It's not about using the institutions, except in a very instrumental sense. But, I mean, I would say, you know, threatening someone in the performance of any legal duty should not be limited to DMPs. Just, you know, top tip, you know, don't do it to IRR researchers, for instance. you know, like, okay, guys, please don't threaten me with physical harm or whatever. I'm a sensitive soul, that, you know, deep down. Yeah, Chris, I know where you live. the EFF has made, I think has demonstrated a generalized contempt for you know, courts, for the legislature, for whatever. Unfortunately, I think it got a lot of this culture from the ANC. The ANC, I think, has more investment in it, and you know, shows you know, I think at its most cynical reasoning, shows more you know, is clever in the way that it works around them. But you know, I do think that there are some within the ANC who are sincere constitutionalists. The EFF is not not like that. The language of threat and menace and whatever is intrinsic to its to its brand. The phrase that, you know, one hears from more than time to time in the media about toxic masculinity. I think this is exactly, you know, the type of idea that you could that you could apply to the EFF's brand of politics.
Chris, any thoughts before we finish up?
Just when someone shows you who they are, believe them. How many examples do you need?
Well said, well said. Okay, so I've been waiting the whole show for this story, and I think we should end on a lighter note.
Thank you.
A nursing home has been heavily criticized and forced to apologize in Taiwan after they have apparently hired strippers to perform for senior citizens. The Taoyuan Veterans Home, which is a state-run facility in Taiwan for retired army personnel, paid a group of strippers to do an erotic show for the older residents of the facility as part of efforts to lift their spirits. Apparently, the last couple of years, they've had to cancel their events due to COVID. And someone took footage of this, which shows all of the old veterans sitting in wheelchairs, having strippers dance on them while wearing masks and lingerie. And the rest home nurses are in the background clapping along to the performance. In a statement, the old age home said, "The intention of the event was to entertain residents and make them happy. We are very sorry for the offense caused." They also admitted that perhaps the entertainers' actions were, quote, too enthusiastic and fiery. Chris, anything to say?
I mean, Terence often writes about the capable state, and I don't think there's a better argument for the capable state than this story. So thank you, Terence. I think this backs up your argument 100%.
Terence,
you know, I think if I'm in my 80s and I can appreciate a, you know, like a 20 year old, you know, strutting her stuff, I think that's a good thing, actually. Interestingly, though, I do, you know, I lived in Taiwan, and I remember once asking about the legal status of prostitution.
Here we go.
And I was told very sort of very ambivalent. But they say that apparently there were certain places that were known, which would never be raided or hassled because they catered to army veterans. This was a big thing in Taiwan. You know, veterans of the Chinese Civil War, World War II, sort of politically protected by the Kuomintang. So yes, you know, while you know, your garden variety escort agency might get shaken down from time to time, there were places where you just didn't go because you knew who was there. And yeah, look, you know, I think if it lifts your spirits and you don't need a blue pill, go for it, man. You know, that's my
answer. Taiwan's taxes are clearly being put to good use. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. We hope that you enjoy the show. If you found it interesting, we will be back, of course, tomorrow on the Daily French Show. And we all hope that you have a wonderful day. Cheers, everyone.